This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Thank you very much. And to connect my presentation with this wonderful analysis of all the diseases and maladies, I'll just mention a little anecdote about Beckett, who, as is well known, had as much trouble getting up as Boswell. And the story is that when he had to teach, first time teaching at the École Normale Supérieure, he was given a class at noon, and he had only one student who became a friend, Alfred Perron, who around one finally decided to see what was happening, went to Beckett's room that was not locked, and he saw Beckett still sleeping happily, and just put a little note and said, "Let's meet tonight." And then after that, they only had their classes at night. So you have one image, and I have to say that I was too lazy to find more than one, but you have at least one image that will talk to what I'll be presenting on, which is Beckett's fascination for Bellaqua. And I'll begin with a little joke that some of you may have read or reread, reading Bertrand Russell's In Praise of Idleness. An old joke: a British traveler visiting Naples sees 12 beggars lying contentedly in the sun and offers a lira to the laziest of them. 11 beggars jump up to claim the lira. The traveler gives the money to the 12th man, who hasn't moved. This story finds countless variations, especially in the genre known in French as Corsican jokes. There are many, many of them. Like a typical one, a young man who's never left his island arrives to Marseille and is about to start his job. Next day, has been told that money is found everywhere in the streets of Marseille. He sees a 50-franc banknote on the sidewalk, passes by, saying, "I'll just begin working tomorrow." So each culture, each social group, takes another group as the lazy one. And I'd like to say that Russell's joke has its archetype in a more grandiose metaphysical framework in Dante's Commedia. And it was Samuel Beckett's distinction not only to have discovered it, but also to take it from its context and promote it, turning it into a mask for himself. Anyone who has read Beckett systematically has encountered this character, Bellaqua Sure, who is the hero of the first novel, Dream of Fair to Middling Women, and also the hero of the collection of stories called More Pricks Than Kicks, in which, is, if you've read it, as you may know, at the end, Bellaqua Sure dies. In the opening lines of the first story of More Pricks Than Kicks, Dante and the Lobster, we have this hero, Bellaqua, who is stuck like his namesake, and I quote, "It was morning, and Bellaqua was stuck in the first of the canty of the moon. He was so bogged that he could move neither backward nor forward." This is not, and we could go on reading those canty of the moon and how Beatrice helps him understand the spots, the meaning of the spots on the moon. Bellaqua himself appears a little earlier in Purgatorio, and I'll return to that. He appears in a very particular place, which is the ante-purgatory. Dante has been progressing steadily with his guide, Virgil, when suddenly he hears a voice exclaiming, translation, "Perhaps you will have need to sit before you reach that point." Startled, Virgil and Dante turn around and see a massive boulder, which you have here, under which a group of people has gathered. And this is the portrait, or this is where Doré took his inspiration. I quote, We made our way toward the boulder, toward it, and toward the people who lounged behind it in the shade, as men who by listlessness will rest. And one of them, who seemed to me exhausted, was sitting with his arms around his knees. Between his knees, he kept his head bent down. "Oh, my sweet Lord," I said, "look carefully at one who shows himself more languid than he would have been were laziness his sister." Then that shade turned towards us attentively, lifting his eyes, but just above his thigh, and said, "Climb, then, if you're so vigorous." Before, in that canto, Dante had expressed to Virgil his own fears that the road upward would be a little steep and that perhaps he would not be able to follow his guide. He calls himself lasso, exhausted, and he makes a plea and to ask Virgil to stop a little, and Virgil reassures him. Then, once he has found new forces and this eagerness to ascend to the mountain of purgatory, he hears that strange, derisive voice. And to one who is in a group, the group of the exhausted ones. In a few words, Bellacqua then asks Dante whether he has seen that the sun rays are now passing to his left. It is because Bellacqua is so short of words that Dante recognizes him and goes towards him with a smile. I quote, "The slowness of his movements, his brief words, had stirred my lips a little toward a smile. Then I began, 'From this time on, Bellacqua, I need not grieve for you, but tell me, why do you sit here? Do you expect a guide? Or have you fallen into your old ways?' And he, 'Brother, what's the use of climbing?'" We have to note that Bellacqua's expression is startlingly idiomatic. "O frate, andara in su che porta?" Literally, "Oh brother, what's the point of going up?" One may guess that the wan smile that Beckett will describe many times in his works, with perhaps freeze on his lips when he hears the final question, it's a little like a cynical remark that could be modernized out. "Why the hell do you want to be saved?" It is so shocking, this remark, that Dante has to provide an acceptable eschatological rationale, which duly follows. In the next lines, we hear a more complex explanation. Bellacqua explains that he has waited until the last minute to repent for his past sins, since I delayed good size until the end, and that, therefore, he has been condemned to wait in ante-purgatory a number of years equal to the years he spent on earth, unless a worthy soul prays for him. Later, Beckett, totally identified with Bellacqua, had added this idea that he hoped there would never be any good soul who would pray for him, to shorten the duration of his stay. Ironically, Bellacqua's delayed entrance to purgatory has been rejected by a sitting angel, God's angel, he who guards at the gate. This is my translation, could be l'angel d'angel di Dio che siede in sulla porta, who sits at the gate. What we know of Bellacqua derives mostly from the first commentary on Dante by Benvenuto de Rambaldis, who wrote at some length about Bellacqua, and this is what he says. "It must be known that the voice belonged to that lazy person named Bellacqua. He was from Florence and built guitars and other musical instruments. He then carved them and engraved them with much care, and sometimes he played some of them. For this reason, Dante knew him well, since he was delighted by music. Since he was known by everybody as a very lazy person, although not depraved, but rather pure, for this reason, Dante has him saved. Now, our poet describes in a special manner a friend whose laziness was greater than that of anyone he knew at the time, so that When Dante reproached him for his laziness, he used to reply that his soul would become wiser by sitting and resting, quod anima sedendo et quiescendo fit sapiens, which is something that Beckett often quotes. All these elements are used by Beckett in some manner in Dream of Fair to Meeting Women, and especially in one fragment published by Beckett in Transition in 1932. It was entitled Sedendo and Quiescendo and contains the description of Bellacqua, the initial description of Bellacqua. Bellacqua, capital letters. We had to call him, and no indolent virgin is his sister, parenthesis, indolent virgin, exclamation mark. And he does not care much whether he plays the tinkle-tinkle of a four-hander or not, allusion to the instruments. But he won't be facing the keyboard to observe the rule of the road, parenthesis, a megalomaniac, you see, with his head in his thighs as a general rule, end quote, and parenthesis. So we ask you to humor now what naturally looks merely like so much intestinal incohesion. Remember, he belongs to the costermonger time of a pale and ardent generation. Pray that he will let a few good sighs out of him ere it be too late, and speedy promotion from the god birds. You recognize here the rather convoluted idiom of Dream, which explains partly why it was rejected by all publishers. Even after Beckett chose alter egos, different alter egos, Murphy, Molloy, they all tend to have a Bellacqua moment, a moment of regression to what Murphy, for instance, calls Bellacqua bliss. That is, the ability to live in one's mind and reach a certain contemplation, sedendo et quiescendo. In the later text, The Lost Ones, Le Deux Peuples in French, one category of the inmates in the strange cylinder is defined as, quote, those who do not search, or non-searchers, sitting for the most part against the wall in the attitude which wrung from Dante one of his rare wan smiles. However, this time, the smile may not so readily spread to the readers. In the Bellacqua fantasy that defines the bizarre Dantean hell of the Lost Ones, the tone is eerily sinister. The inmates, who are like Bellacqua and sit prostrate, seem to have lost all hope. We know that Beckett had just read Primo Levi's Sequestro Nuomo about Auschwitz, and these Bellacqua-like inmates, inhabitants, are those that Primo Levi mentioned as being the Muslims in the camps, those who've lost any hope. In the strange text of The Lost Ones, Beckett structures and even mathematizes the unthinkable, the Shoah, and the plight of survivors, and he tests the mental resistance of the imaginary world pictured by Dante, reducing it to the dimension of a cylinder, which is an interesting concept I return to. In the Purgatorio, we have to note that Bellacqua is not technically among the slothful who are seen in Canto 18. The slothful are punished in a strange and interesting manner. They were slow, so they are made to run without stopping, and their tongues never stop speaking, but their tongues speak about sloth, dando alexidia di morso. And this time it is the term acidia that is used, mocking sloth or making a dent into sloth. And for instance, the slothful have to condemn endlessly the tardy Hebrews who failed to follow Moses and died in the desert without glory. They have to deride endlessly the Trojans who stopped in Sicily and failed to share in the glory of Aeneas in Rome. At that point in the canto, symptomatically, Dante himself is overwhelmed by sleep, and he embarks on a long erotic dream in which he is tempted by the charms of a siren. It is a very bizarre passage in the Purgatorio. And earlier even, when he sees the words of the slothful, It's like a dream, like one who, nearing sleep, has random visions. It is crucial to note that Belacqua, therefore, does not fit very neatly in the symbolic geography of the purgatory. Belacqua sits in the ante-purgatory, which appears as a transitional space between the inferno and the purgatorio, and it is a sort of limbo for adults, like the limbo in which we see Aristotle and so on at the beginning of the Commedia in Hell. And it seems to be a limbo for adults who, as Beckett would say, have never been properly born. One knows that Beckett heard Jung say this about a little girl of 10 who died because of a too systematic immersion into her dreams. And this was the key to Murphy when you're struggling to complete Murphy. Belacqua is therefore this figure, this allegory, you might say, of an ironist, an indolent and insolent questioner who, because he's stuck somewhere, whether by his own will or by the angel's decree is hard to say, in that anti-purgatory can voice a critical, humorous, an anti-heroic objection to the very pattern of the quest upon which Dante is embarked. In a sense, Belacqua is like Guido da Montefeltro, who in Inferno tells Dante that he is ready to confess his sins only because he knows that Dante will never return to the world of the living and thus will never divulge these. Most readers know about Guido thanks to Eliot's love song of J. Alfred Prufrock, in which the epigraph comes from this Guido da Montefeltro passage. But for American readers of a certain generation, Belacqua's face tends to merge with that of another allegorical character, Alfred E. Neumann, not Alfred Prufrock, who used to grace the zany covers of Mad magazine. Like Belacqua, the "what me worry" seems to be an assertion of the primacy of indolence. This urgent debunking, andar in su que porta, asserts that no theological, no political system rules over them. In Belacqua's case, this ends up challenging the very similitude of the whole epic genre. Belacqua's facetious remark problematizes the theological nature of Dante's movement upward. His globular or spherical body pose transforms it into a sort of monad, an opaque monad, indolently insulated from outside aggressions. Indolence means, as you know, who cannot suffer. His equable horizontality clashes with the ascent of verticality taken so far as the only way to reach the ultimate good. Such a passive subversion is enough to undermine from within a narrative structure that has been taken for granted so far. This would be the subtly subversive power of sloth. The deployment of the Belacqua fantasy can be reframed in the context of what French historian Jacques Le Goff has called the invention of purgatory in the Middle Ages. Le Goff explains why this concept imposed itself slowly between the 10th and the 13th century. And his book, The Birth of Purgatory, which is really remarkable, provides an archaeology of what he calls the third place that was, of course, systematically refused then by Luther and the Protestants. The first fathers of the church had only two places, hell and paradise. Origen, first, who, as the story goes, was castrated by himself, then St. Augustine gave shape to a new eschatological hope by defining purgatory punishments, but at that time purgatory was an adjective, for the souls of the sinners. At the beginning of the 12th century, the purgatory fire turned into the purgatory that had to be a place. The creation of an intermediary site halfway between the good and the evil souls, the saved and the damned, corresponds, as Le Goff shows, to important social transformations and new economic relations. And of course, the church, for one, profited enormously from the invention of the third space and from the state of indulgences, which, by the way, brought many of the popes to be denounced and by Dante and put in hell by Dante. All this had to do with reducing the number of years one could stay in purgatory. But from my general calculations, for those of you who may still be worried, it wasn't too many years, rarely more than 300 years that you'd be in purgatory. So what Le Goff shows is that there was, between the 10th and 13th century, an entire epistemic mutation, and that it created a new imaginary world. It was resolved in two moments. The dogma of purgatory was promulgated by the Council of Lyons in 1274, and then confirmed by the Council of Florence in 1439. In between, of course, it was Dante elaborating his vision of the three worlds who gave most poetic prestige to the tripartite vision of the zones. But the only one who seems to be resisting this is Bellacqua and his friends, who sit still. Luther had no difficulty in refuting the idea of purgatory. It has no foundation in the scriptures. He attributed it rightly to the fertile imagination of Origen. For him and the Protestants, this was a Greek myth tainted with Neoplatonism, imported fraudulently into Christian eschatology. Catholic theology later recognized that the purgatory was a creation of tradition, and that it needed to allegorize the state of purgation needed for the soul. Beckett's Protestant origin did not, of course, predispose him well to an immediate belief in the purgatory, and he often voiced hesitations. Here is one of many parodic passages, and I've taken them from an abandoned work. Quote, "Ah, my father and mother, to think they are probably in paradise, they were so good. Let me go to hell, that's all I ask, and go on cursing them there, and them look down and hear me, that might take some of the shine on their bliss. Yes, I believe all their blather about the life to come. It cheers me up, and unhappiness like mine, there's no annihilating that." Villiers de L'Isle-Adam had narrated in his Nouveau Conte Cruel how Abbé Tusser, an inveterate gambler who was losing, had no money left, offering to ask for an extension and new stakes, and he said he would reveal to his partners the best hidden secret of the church. He loses again, he has to tell them the secret. The secret is that there is no purgatory. Beckett would not be as radical as Villiers de L'Isle-Adam. This is, for instance, what he wrote about Joyce's Finnegan's Wake. "A last word about the purgatories. Dante's is conical and consequently implies culmination. Mr. Joyce's is spherical and excludes culmination. In the one, absolute progression and a guaranteed consummation. In the other, flux, progression or retrogression, and an apparent consummation. In the one, movement is unidirectional, and a step forward represents a net advance. In the other, movement is non-directional or multidirectional, and a step forward is by definition a step back." In that sense, you might say that Beckett's purgatory is closer to Joyce's than to that of Dante. And he says, indeed, in what sense then is Mr. Joyce's work purgatorial? In the absolute absence of the absolute. However, as we know, Beckett did not share Joyce's linguistic and perhaps theological optimism. For Joyce, even if one cannot reach culmination, as long as the verbal machine purrs on, the process purifies by its very progression. There is no reason to stop at any time. There is no reason to be bogged down. And this is why Finnegan's Wake is a circular text that is also virtually infinite. For Beckett, purgation and purgatory remain problematic notions. Are they exhausted notions? Are they exhausting notion? In Company, finally, a later text, the narrator bids farewell to the indolent lutist assuming that after all those centuries, Delacroix finally found a place among the blessed. So sat waiting to be purged, the old lutist, cause of Dante's first quarter mile, and now perhaps singing praises with some section of the blessed at last, to whom here, in any case, farewell. Is this a farewell to Delacroix, or is this a farewell to the blessed? Delacroix's nagging question, what does it bring you to go upward, my friend, take it easy, seems to be the best antidote to any purgatorial teleology or theology of progress. Facing the myth of religious, political, or artistic progress, the indolence of sloth might be the only answer that one could truly give.